Your name, please.
Massey H. Shepherd, Jr.
And your occupation and position.
I'm professor of liturgics at the Church Divinity School of the Pacific, a seminary of the Episcopal Church in Berkeley, California.
Dr. Shepherd, as a non-Roman Catholic observer of the Vatican Council, what was your personal reaction to it?
My viewpoint is that this is probably the most important event in the history of Christianity in our century.
This is Viewpoint, an unrehearsed and personal interview with the Reverend Massey H. Shepherd, Jr., who will reveal to you what he holds to be the responsibilities of his position in life, produced by the Episcopal Church and brought to you as a public service by this station. Mr. Kennedy's guest today is the Reverend Massey H. Shepherd, Jr., professor of liturgics at the Church Divinity School of the Pacific, a seminary of the Episcopal Church in Berkeley, California. Here is the moderator of the award-winning series, Viewpoint, the Reverend Dana F. Kennedy. Mr. Kennedy.
Welcome to Viewpoint, Dr. Massey Shepherd, Jr. When you say important, what are your criteria you use for importance?
First of all, the Roman Catholic Church represents one half of all the Christians in the world, and this was the first time in a century in which its leaders had come together to consider the most urgent matters facing Christianity, not merely in the Roman Catholic Church, but generally the Christian witness in the world today.
What do you think was the motivation for their calling the Ecumenical Council? Was it a move of desperation or what?
Well, the motivation was given by Pope John himself. He said that it came by divine inspiration, and I rather think he's right.
And how did it conduct itself? What was its modus of working?
The bishops, of course, debated documents and papers that were prepared for them in advance by preparatory commissions. And then during the sessions, these were revised and amended constantly until the bishops found them in satisfactory form to vote either in favor or against them. And when this was done, those that were approved were then promulgated by the Pope for implementation in the life of the Church.
And what great areas of concern did they cover?
They covered almost everything. There were several very important doctrinal statements, for example, the one on the Revelation and the Bible, the one on the nature of the Church and its ministry, one on the liturgy and worship of the Church. Then there were many concerned with the internal structure of the Church, the function of bishops, the missionary activity of the Church, the religious orders, and so forth. And then there was the very important one dealing with the Church in the world today, which dealt with basic problems that face all mankind. And this last one was addressed not merely to church people, but to all concerned human beings.
Was there any change that took place within the body of bishops that were meeting that made it a different kind of spirit and body at the end than at the beginning?
I think the change of spirit came perhaps fairly early in the council when they took their first significant vote and discovered that they were their own masters in the council.
And how did this differ from prior conceptions?
Well, many people thought that the council would be largely manipulated by certain ones who would simply present them with what they were supposed to vote on, and that there would not be the free and open discussion and great amendment of material, and so that the bishops themselves took the lead from those who had prepared the material for them.
And has the effect of the council been to make any drastic changes on a worldwide scale?
Well, there have certainly been already some very fundamental changes in the Roman Catholic Church itself, which in turn will affect very definitely its relationship to other Christians as well as to its own witness to the world.
Is this a kind of reformation, or wouldn't it be fair to call it that?
Undoubtedly, I would call it a reformation.
And what has been the effect on churches that are not Roman Catholic?
The fact that Pope John invited the observers from the other churches, and most of them responded to this gracious invitation for the first time, meant a new kind of dialogue, a new kind of spirit of relationship between Christians who have been hitherto not only separated but often hostile, that has entirely changed the atmosphere of the total Christian situation in the world.
What have been some of the major barriers, and how are they changing?
There have always, of course, been certain doctrinal barriers in beliefs of the various churches in which they have held very strongly and which have seemed to be almost impossible of reconciliation. There have also been canonical or legal structural differences that have made it difficult hitherto to engage in dialogue on any official basis.
What sort of doctrinal problems have there been that have been of great importance?
Well, those most obvious, of course, are those that have to do with the primacy and infallibility of the Pope, and for many also the modern dogmas regarding the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Do you find that in dialogue that tends that one church or denomination lines up one way and the other church lines up another? Is this the way it works?
No, in my experience, limited as it's been, in all encounters of this sort that I've engaged in, whether at this international level or in national or local discussions, it very frequently happens that divisions of opinion and understanding about these matters divide within particular church bodies rather than between them.
Would you consider this hopeful?
Very hopeful. For example, I belong to an ecumenical discussion group in the Bay Area in California, made up of Roman Catholics and non-Roman Catholics, and if you brought a blind man into the room of our discussion, he couldn't separate us.
What has been some of the effects on the non-Roman Catholic churches of the Ecumenical Council and the whole? Is there any relationship between the Ecumenical Council and the ecumenical movement?
Very definitely, in that already there has been established a liaison between the Roman Catholic Church and the World Council of Churches. And I think now at all levels of ecumenical discussion, whether at the world level or at the national level, or at least at the level of discussion between specific churches, it is now impossible to think about the reunion of Christians without taking into consideration the fact of the Roman Catholic Church and of the Orthodox churches of the East. That is to say, the ecumenical movement, which up until Vatican Council was largely a Protestant affair with some participation by the Eastern Orthodox churches, now has had a very new dimension given to it.
Is the World Council of Churches deeply related to the ecumenical movement?
The World Council of Churches is the only organized agency of the world ecumenical movement up to this point, where the Roman Catholic Church has started to enter into this dialogue.
We talk a lot these days, Dr. Shepherd, about change. Is this change part of the impetus for ecumenicity?
Modern change is largely the result of technology, which has created throughout our society, our world society, an entirely new situation for mankind. And with it has come a very definite change in the relationship which Christian churches have had, more or less, to the societies in which they were well established. And in this sense, the changes in the modern world have made it imperative for Christians to take a new look at their own situation, the posture of their mission and witness, and so forth.
Has there been any great increase in the other world religions in our modern world?
I do not recall statistics of growth. There has certainly been a revival within Islam, for example, which has been very much related to the nationalistic movements of the countries where Islam is dominant, and there has also been certainly a renewal within Buddhism and Hinduism, partly in reaction to the impact of Christian mission in the cultures where they have been dominant.
Do you think that modern people have any special problems that weigh upon their minds and their hearts, even if they aren't able to articulate them?
Well, I think the problems of modern people, since you put it to me generally, are the sort of problems that the Vatican Council is trying to reach in the document on the Church and the World today. That is to say, those issues which, for the vast majority of mankind, are constantly before them in their daily life, having to do, for example, with the problems of population increase, the availability of sufficient food, poverty, all of this area. Above all, the problem of war and peace and nuclear warfare in particular. Such questions as these, which everybody, whether Christians or not, are faced with today.
Are these religious problems?
Well, anything that concerns the welfare of mankind seems to me is religious.
I wonder if this is a common concept.
Well, there are many people that do not think so, because they think that Christianity deals with what they call spiritual problems. But after all, man isn't a disembodied spirit. And I would say that, at least in classic Christianity, there has always been this deep concern for man's physical welfare and social welfare, no less than his spiritual welfare.
What place does the church within the city, or right on the corner, or wherever it may be, have with these problems that we're talking about in the lives of everyone?
Well, the church is made up of people. One defines the church as people. That is, people with a particular attitude, point of view, belief, and style of life. And they live, like those who are not members of the church, by and large, in the world, and are concerned very much with the same problems.
Is what happens within the church when it meets together of any help in meeting these problems?
It's of help in that it is always, I think, a strengthening of any group's witness to come together and to find consensus and new directions as to their way of witness and behavior in the world. Of course, the final test is the extent to which they implement their good resolutions at occasions like this.
How do you feel about the rather common saying that some people have, that you can be just as good outside not going to church as if you went to church?
Well, this again depends on how you would define goodness. If it's just a mere matter of morality, I think that's true. If it's a matter of a basic attitude with regard to the human condition and the destiny of humankind, and a sense of reverence and obedience to that which is ultimate in claims of on human life, then I think the religious man has an advantage.
Dr. Shepherd, in the worship that goes on within the church, is there something special that helps build, maintain this deep outlook on life?
Yes, I do, because worship is fundamentally an acknowledgement of the sovereignty of God in the world which He made. It is, for Christians above all, an acknowledgement of a very unique and special act which God did on behalf of mankind in His evil and in His despair and in His hopelessness and in His sin. And hence exposure consciously to this experience of acknowledgement undoubtedly affects the totality of a man's style of life in all aspects of day-to-day existence.
Does it make any difference what the service itself is like then when the person goes into the church? Are there any basic elements that worship, corporate worship, must contain?
Well, certainly the worship must be intelligible to the people who participate in it, and for Christians, at least, it must speak to them very clearly with regard to the fundamentals of their belief, with regard to the nature of God and how God relates himself to the world, and give at least support to their obedience and conviction and resolution to live out the way they believe.
And does worship keep on being pretty much the same, or is this a changing, growing thing?
Well, worship is always, in its external forms and manner of expression, obviously influenced by the particular culture of the people and period, so that it is always evolving, even though people may often be unconscious of it. There is both continuity and change in Christian worship all the time.
You mean the people bring their culture into the church worship?
Undoubtedly. This is not merely in matters of external ceremonies, but it has to do with even the way in which they express their faith.
Is the communion service or the Mass a service which is accepted by all Christian churches?
I believe all Christian churches have a form of what they call the Lord's Supper, the communion, or the Mass, except the Quakers, who have no sacramental forms of worship.
Is this in any way a basic tie between churches?
Very definitely, because even the great variety of forms of it that you find in the churches, whether elaborate or simple, ultimately and historically stem from the act of our Lord Jesus Christ with his disciples on the last night of his earthly life.
Is it possible to change this service in any way? Does this change with culture?
The fact is that it has changed in its external forms and ceremonies throughout the ages. For example, the Mass in the medieval cathedral externally was a very different looking thing from the way in which Jesus celebrated the supper with his disciples in the upper room in Jerusalem. And certainly the new changes being made in the Roman Catholic and other churches in the form of this act makes it look, externally at least, and even in much of its manner of expression, very different from the Mass of the Church in the Middle Ages. But the primary essentials are still there. A body of disciples gather about a table in thanksgiving to share common gifts of food and drink.
Still speaking about the matter of corporate worship, of going to church on a Sunday, is there any way you feel that a person should approach this worship experience?
Well, I think for Christian people, and after all, worship primarily concerns believing people, though obviously unbelieving people are most welcome to participate, but for believing people for whom worship is a primary a duty and responsibility, as well as joy in life, there is bound to be a particular attitude which they bring to this, which is one of seeking to correct those defects and failures and faults that they acknowledge as inconsistent with their beliefs. There is the desire to offer praise and thanksgiving for the many good things that have come to them, not merely in physical, material way, but in their relationships with people and with one another. There is the desire for deeper insight into the meaning of human existence and human destiny, or what religious people call God's will. All of these factors, I think, enter into the motivation of going to worship.
And in the worship experience itself, what does the prayer part of the worship do?
Prayer is formally a articulate, conscious conversation with God, and it should always, I think, be thought of primarily as conversation with him. But as we make this conversation articulate and conscious, we draw out things that have considerable influence upon ourselves.
And what part does the music have in the worship? Is this always should this be a necessary part?
I think music is a very essential part of worship because through music, man is able to express the totality of his being more adequately than in mere spoken words, because music brings into play the the whole rich area of symbolism, of emotion. It is, I think, simply a common human experience that when people are in the most deep and profound experiences of life, joy, sorrow, fear, that they normally break out in song frequently, often without realizing it.
What about the matter of preaching? Is this still a part of worship that's vital?
Absolutely, because after all, Christianity is by definition good news for the world, and preaching is the setting forth of this good news of what God has done in creation and in the redemption of mankind.
In a sophisticated world like much of modern America, how is the man doing the preaching going to be far enough ahead of his people to say anything of great consequence? Who is he to speak to them?
Well, preaching at its best is not simply the act of the preacher, but it involves a very conscious and attentive response on the part of the listener. Now, of course, the styles of preaching, again, are an aspect of worship which, like other aspects of worship, undergo changes due to cultural traditions. In certain periods, for example, the highly rhetorical kind of sermon was popular, which it is not today. There are all sorts of forms of communicating words, which again are culturally conditioned from time to time, but preaching is not just an individual giving out his ideas. It is a setting forth in a corporate context in which the listener is as important as the preacher of a common faith.
Someone had told me a quotation that Christian worship is not a spectator sport. Is this the way you'd feel about it?
Oh, definitely. It's everyone is in the arena in Christian worship.
Sometimes people make fun of the offering. Is this a vital part of worship?
For most people, I don't know any other way by which they can express their concern for other people, and particularly other people in need, than by making an offering.
I know that you teach at a seminary. Is there any great change coming around in the attitude of the young men coming into the seminary?
I think young men coming into the seminary today are particularly concerned about this large problem of how, in the midst of the tremendous changes going on in our modern world, the church can adapt its ministry and its message to this new situation.
Do you see any great change coming about in the church which these young men will be in, say, 10 years from now? Do you think it will have any similarity to the parish church of today?
Undoubtedly, there will be changes in the traditional structures of parish organization in many places. What is particularly necessary is that these men be trained by actual involvement in live situations in our society.
Thank you very much, Dr. Massey Shepherd, for being with us and for giving us your viewpoint.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
This has been Viewpoint, an unrehearsed and personal interview, produced as a public service by the Division of Radio and Television of the Episcopal Church. Today's guest was the Reverend Massey H. Shepherd, Jr., Professor of Liturgics at the Church Divinity School of the Pacific, a seminary of the Episcopal Church in Berkeley, California.